reminding us a little bit at the beginning about this letter, who this church was, what they were like. And the two little bits of reminder for you. The first little bit of reminder is this. It's the kind of what's happening, the history, what's going on. I'm going to be very brief on it. But the thing about this little church, this church in Thessalonica, it's a brand new church. It's a brand new church. Now, up and down the country, we have brand new churches being opened. Thank God there are churches being planted. In the main, they tend to be replants, really, don't they? There's either an overflow of people at one particular church, they've got no more space, so they just take a group of them and they plant them somewhere else. Or they send out a group, maybe 10, 12 people together, and they send them into an area and start a new church. In other words, there's some established people there already, and they get underway and they start a new work. It's very rare, exceptionally rare, to find a church like this. And this is a church where every single person in that church hasn't been a Christian except for 2 months. Right? Not a single member of this congregation in Thessalonica had been a Christian for more than a couple of months. Which is extraordinary, right? They're all brand new to the faith. This is a new church. I mean a new church. Not a new name for an old church. Or the same group of Christians who've just moved to a different place and started a different work. None of that. This is a brand spanking new work of God. Right? God has started a new thing in Thessalonica. It's never happened before. There's never been a group of Christians in this city ever. There are no other fellowships. There's no other churches. It's just them, and none of them have been in the faith more than a couple of months. So that's amazing in its own right. It's a phenomenon in its right to actually see a pristine, brand new baby church coming into being. And when we looked in Philippians, we saw a church grown up 10 years on, you know. Paul also planted the church in Philippi around about the same time as the church in Thessalonica. But the letter he wrote to them, he wrote 10 years down the line. So we saw a matured church. Here is a church, it's in infancy. It's a baby church. And all the Christians there are young Christians, young in the Lord. And add to that, not only is this brand spanking new church, they are having an absolutely dreadful time. I mean, all hell has broken loose against this church. They are being persecuted, so severely persecuted, not just teased and marginalized and all the rest of it. Some of their members have died. Some of their people have died. Now, you know, we face challenges, and most of us here have been in the Lord, or I think without doubt, everybody here have been in the Lord a great deal longer than any of these people, and have not been tested any way like the same degree that they're being tested. So we come to this with a bit of humility as we see what the Lord is doing in this group of people. And their stand in that city, this infant church, these infant Christians facing this outrageous circumstances, have got such an important job to do. They're in the city of Thessalonica. Thessalonica is not a very old city at this time either. It's a relatively new city. One of these, what you might call like a new town. It's all springing up, everything's live, and there's new stuff coming in and business interests, and they put a new motorway. The Romans have built a new, there was a kind of Roman, Greek road going there, and they've upgraded it. It's like a Roman motorway going through, and, you know, there's lots of, I don't know, they didn't have petrol stations, whatever horses need. And it's also right there by the coast. They've built a new port. They're expanding the port area, the Mediterranean trade. This is a place where there's a buzz. There's stuff coming through. There's brand new things going on. And the communication lines. If you're in charge of Thessalonica, if you've got a presence in Thessalonica, you've got a finger on the pulse on the new developing world, the communication lines going deep into Macedonia, down there into Rome, right out into the Mediterranean. If you can get a preaching center, if you can get a place of distributing ideas, letting people know about Jesus in Thessalonica, you're on the super hub, the kind of new highway, the information highway of the Roman world. So this place to secure a gospel center, a gospel community in the heart of this place is a crucial work, strategically speaking. And who's there doing the work? Who's been entrusted to do the work? Some brand spanking new Christians who haven't been in the Lord more than a couple of months. And they have got a fight on their hands. Because there's other people who quite like to control the city too. and want to have a presence, and they're determined to push them out, and they don't mind if they spill blood to do it. You know, the gloves are off. They're taking no prisoners. And it's the whole city of Thessalonica was always being fought over all the way through history. If you put in Battle of Thessalonica into the search engines now, you get a whole list of all the different battles that have taken place in that place. The Slavs have fought there, the Avars have fought there, the Byzantines have fought there, the Arabs have fought there, the Turks have fought there, the Epirians have fought there, the Bulgars have fought, the Goths have fought there, the Romans have fought there. Everybody's fought over it because it's a really crucial place. It's a crucial place. I love that scripture which says, God has chosen the foolish things of this world, the weak things of this world. I love that scripture. It gives me such confidence, such hope. The foolish things of this world, to bring to nothing those that think they're something, to confound the wisdom of the wise. I mean, all the glory is God's, isn't it? You know, it's all the glory is God's. If you get this little group of people who've got no human agency of power on their side, and they win through, the battle is the Lord's. The battle is the Lord's. I will fight for you. I'll be victorious for you. And that is what we're observing here. We're as we see this letter, we're getting a snapshot of this little group of people fighting for a gospel presence in a completely dark place. And there is so much resting. There is so much resting on this victory. And as we read through the book, as you remember from the beginning, they are doing the most amazing work. You said they're a model. They're setting the pace. They're showing the world. This is how you do Christianity. Isn't that amazing? You can't do that in your own strength, because quite simply, these people have none. They have none. The only strength, whatever strength they have, is the Lord, great and powerful, mighty and majestic. If there's strength or victory at all, it's him, isn't it? And not them. That should be encouraging. That should be encouraging to us, if nothing else. And, you know, they haven't even got, like, a pastor or a Bible teacher or an experienced Christian who can come alongside them and mix amongst them and do some teaching. They haven't got, like, DVDs and, you know, they haven't even probably got printed New Testaments. They've got nothing. They've got nothing. So little experience and few helpful people. They had the Apostle Paul, who came to found the church. We say, oh, they had the Apostle Paul to found the church. You know how long he was there? A week. They had 1 week to learn everything they had to learn about Christ and find the rest and mine the rest of it out of the Old Testament. Right? They had a week of Bible teaching with one of the greatest Bible teachers that's ever lived, thank God. But that was it. And this letter, he finally gets to write them a letter, doesn't he? A couple of months into the battle. The battle is raging. And they're glorifying Christ in the midst of their sufferings and their persecutions. And he writes them this letter. It's a bit like, you know, the commander, you know, as he observes their battle, their situation, he writes them this letter. And he's only got a little bit of time, and he can say just a few pertinent things to them, some important direction, some encouragements, you're doing great, that sort of stuff. Keep fighting. Don't give up. And just to lead and direct them and point them how to secure victory, because this is a man of experience. Whatever the Apostle Paul is, I'm like everybody else. Every time you read Paul's list of experiences, shipwreck, 3 days, you just go, I've never met anybody with as much experience, Christian experience, than this man. It's absolutely staggering. Absolutely staggering. So they have somebody who could speak into their lives, and that is absolutely wonderful, isn't it? And what he's actually calling for, as you go through to the letter, is after all his encouragements and so on, he gets down to the substance of the letter, chapter 4. He's saying, I want you to concentrate on your own personal holiness. On your own personal holiness. And he encourages them, and he says, the Lord is returning, the Lord is coming. The Lord is coming. Keep looking up. The Lord is coming. But what do you do right now? What are you going to do right now? How can you keep this going forward? How can you stop yourself from surrendering to the pressures? How can you overcome it? Be holy. Be holy. Makes me think of another battle that took place that we've got a record of in the book of Exodus chapter 17, when all the children of Israel left the Egypt and went out into the wilderness. And the first military engagement that the Israelites had to experience for themselves, they were, I think, if my memory serves me, I can't remember, one of the Kites or the Malites or something like that. I can't actually remember which one. There's a bunch of tribes people anyway, attacked them. I think it was a place called Rephidim, I'm not quite sure. Joshua went out and led the charge. And the Israelites went out into their first ever military engagement. They'd been slaves all their life, never had to do anything like that for themselves, and they had to go and fight. And Moses sat himself down on a mountain, didn't he, overlooking the battlefield. And as he stood there on the battlefield, he wasn't in the fight with them. They were actually in there, blood and guts, doing it. But he sat there on the hillside, and Aaron, the two of them sat on either side holding up Moses' hands, so his hands were outstretched like this. So every time they were wearied in the battle, every time they were despairing of life, every time they felt overwhelmed by their circumstances, every time they thought, these men I'm fighting against are seasoned soldiers, and who am I? I was building bricks last week. They would look up and they would see a figure like this on the mountainside. And they would go, push on, push on. And when his hands were lifted up, the battle was won. And when his hands began to lower down like this, they lost their heart and they lost their strength, didn't they? And the battle was being lost. And the men came along and they supported him until eventually, with that inspiration and encouragement, they overcame and they won that battle. And I think Paul is like that. Paul, like Moses on the mountain, he's not in the battle with them, but he's standing, as it were, on the hillside, which is where commanders often would oversee the battle from the hillside, strategically overseeing what was taking place. But they have an opportunity to look up and see him there. And in the same way, I believe that ultimately Moses was pointing them to Christ with his outstretched arms like this. I think that when they look at Paul, that's what he does. That's the service that he renders them. He makes them look at Christ in the midst of their battle. Jesus is coming. And that stirs their hearts. So they press on and they keep going forward. Chapter 4, as we look at chapter 4, we get down to the drilling into the detail, though, of what looking to Christ means in their, how it changes their lives. The things that, you know, that's the other thing a commander does. He points. This is where the battle needs to be fought. This is where you've got to concentrate your efforts. This is where you've got to redouble your efforts. And he focuses on personal holiness, sexual purity. That, in short, in modern parlance, is a good marriage. Work on your marriages. Work on your own personal part in containing yourself as a sexual animal or whatever you want to call it. That will help you win this battle. Then he moves on, doesn't he, to the point of fellowship, the importance of fellowship, loving your brothers. If you like, have good Christian friends. Building good Christian relationships with your fellow Christian men and women and across the board, building a network of loving support. That will help you win the battle. And then thirdly, he goes on to good business relationships. He advises us about they've got to make it their ambition to live quiet lives, minding their own business, working with their hands, and so on and so forth. And just concentrate that your work life, how you are out in the world, the way you commend Christ to others, the way you deal with others, all these sort of things, that's where the battle is going to be won. In fact, it's in the everyday things. It's not glamorous. Christianity, in one sense, it's not glamorous. It's you and the missus and your mate next door. And your colleagues at work, and the way you live your life in light of what Christ has done for you, the way you shine in this world, that's where the battle is going to be fought, and that is where the battle is going to be won. And he directs them to these things. But I am now going to get round to the text, I promise. I always take ages though when I get around to the actual text. Andy's sitting there going, yes, he does, ages and ages. After your last introduction, mate, you can talk. Right. But he But it's not just Christ that he points them to. And it's not just drawing attention to himself that Paul points them to. There's something else, some other people that he wants them to notice. And that's where we come into the point, right? Other people that he wants them to notice. 1 Thessalonians 12 and verse 13. In the midst of the battle, he says, now we ask you, brothers, in the midst of this battle, in the midst of this struggle, respect those who work hard amongst you, who are over you in the Lord, who admonish you, hold them in the highest regard in love because of their work. This is a crucial component towards that victory. A crucial component. He says ask. In the NIV translation, it says ask. Erateo in the King James. Beseech. Beseech. It's got so much more gravity, doesn't it, than just I ask you, as it's a courteous, polite English sort of way of speaking. I beseech you. There's a pleading here with them to draw their attention to something of vital importance, crucial to their victory. He wants them to listen to what he has to say and pay good attention to this. It's crucial. He wants them to show some respect. Show some respect. Oida is the Greek word there. To have regard for someone or something. To cherish something and appreciate it. To pay attention to something. And there are many, many things that Christians have to pay attention to. Many, many important things. But here in the midst of the battle, in the midst of their situation, he wants them to respect, have regard for, cherish and pay attention those who work hard. Do you see that? Work hard. Working hard amongst them. See, they may be looking at Paul out there somewhere, waiting for news from him. Maybe looking up to heaven for Jesus to return. But he wants them to look around and see that there are people working hard amongst them. There are people close to the ground, right by them, near to them, who God has put in their midst. And he wants them to see that and respect that and appreciate what the Lord is doing there, on the ground, right where they are. Right? To work hard. It's a kind of interesting word, the way they translated it as work hard. The Greek word kopos. Kopos, I think, which is where we get coping from. Okay? And it's also where you get a cooper. Do you know what a cooper is? They make barrels, don't they? People who make barrels. And the way you make a barrel is you get some metal and you get a hammer and you beat it and you beat it and you beat it and you beat the metal into a shape and you fit the wood in there like that. Kopos, the Greek word, is basically to do with beating. It's a military term. People who are koposes are people who can take and give a beating. Soldiers. People who are toughing it out. People who are rolling their sleeves up. People who are stuck in. People who are leading the charge, who are fighting the fight. And what he's saying is that the great apostle Paul has swept through and gone on. But look, in the midst of the battle, in the midst of your trials, in the midst of your infancy and your weakness, God is working and raising up people right next to you. Look what he's doing. He is raising up soldiers for Christ in your own midst, leaders in your own midst. And in short, what's happening is it's like a discipleship process or a teaching process. He's realizing, he wants them to see that there's a handover of power taking place, that you don't need me anymore in one sense. God is raising up people amongst you. A leadership for your church. Not a flying bishop. Bishops who kind of zip around overseeing great dioceses or nations and archbishops and so forth. But congregational leaders, people who God raises up with the power and strength and the ability to take this your group forward in the gospel to the glory of Christ. People who can take a beating because they're not afraid of getting stuck into the battle. And they can give a beating in that sense, in a God-glorifying sort of way. It's more blessed to give than it is to receive, isn't it? Who is in the heart of the battle round here? Who round here is in the thick of it? Who's taking the blows? Who's given them? around here. Paul is saying, open your eyes and see what's going on in your own midst. See the people who are working hard, as the NIV translates it, in your own midst. You know, I so thank God for great towering ministries around the world today, and I thank God in this modern age that we can access so much of that. I can just 2 clicks and I'm at John Piper. It's absolutely fantastic to hear some of the best preaching in the world today. I can listen to Martin Lloyd Jones. But in the end, nobody is better suited to leading a local church than the people who are part of the local church. Because only they can contextualize the gospel to this particular situation. I thank God for John Piper, but do you honestly, what does he know about us? Well, he knows quite a lot. He knows some, he has some experience. But do we need to take what he says and translate it into our own local situation? Yes, we do. I love all the big worship stuff that you get on the stuff like this, the big bands and stuff like that. It's marvelous. But if that isn't us, we have to contextualize that to us. We have to worship God. We have to find our voice to sing his praises here in this place, in the language that's true to our hearts. We have to preach Christ relevantly here. And so who can lead that work but the people who are here and take it forwards? And that's what he's beginning to say. There's a new church, but this church, he's saying, you've got to recognize that God is raising up leaders amongst you, and in the end, they are going to be absolutely crucial to the forward march and development of your congregation. You've got to recognize and appoint leaders. You know, the church in Philippi had already got elders and deacons and so on and so forth. That's 10 years down the line. This little group had not appointed anybody. But just because there are no appointments, God had appointed people. God had put people in their midst with the gifts that were necessary to give leadership, to inspire, to encourage, to direct the work. It was already happening in their midst. Because Ephesians, if we wanted to turn that, says that God gives gifts to the church, doesn't he? He gives leaders to the church. Right? Apostles, prophets, teachers, pastors, all the rest of it, right? It's God's gift. It's God's gift. And I believe that true Christian leadership is local, exemplary Christianity. In other words, the outstanding believers in the local situation. By their example, by their fruits, by their energies, by their efforts. It's quite, this word kopos, it basically, it's a kind of effort that is a thoroughly exhausting, blacksmiths. You know, it takes your whole effort, you know, bang, bang, you know. They're thrown into this. They're thrown into it. Committed to winning their battles. Who is going to be more committed to winning the battle for Christ here in North Bradley than us lot, in truth, than the people on the ground, the people who are connected, the people involved? I mean, with the best will in the world, even the Apostle Paul was now writing from Corinth. He had other concerns, other things that he had to give his energies, but nobody could be more committed to the work in Thessalonica than the Thessalonians. So who best to lead them than them? And that's what he's doing. He's handing it over to them, isn't he? He's saying, recognize that that is the way this is going. I honestly don't know. I mean, apart from what he tells me, what John Piper's, you know, how much he's committed to his own personal marriage or his friendships. And I'm sure he's fantastic. I've no doubt he wouldn't have got as far as he has because of the respect that other people in his own congregation have given him and so on and so forth. I have no doubt. But in terms of accountability, you know more about me. You know more about my comings and goings, don't you? Because you see me like 2 or 3 times a week about how committed I am to my marriage, about how committed I am to my friendships, my fellow Christians, about how committed I am to dealing in a just and upright way in my manner and the things that I do. And we know that about each other, broadly speaking. We hold that in love, I trust, and not in a critical, nasty way, but we do know each other. So if you recognize gifts amongst you, you know that those things are pretty solid. You know the worth of them. You know the real substance of it and how much weight they can actually bear. And that's the kind of leadership that he's talking about. Because it's out of their experience and what you've seen demonstrated in their lives that if you need help with your marriage, you need help with your friendships, or you need help with your business dealings, you can turn to one of these people who's showing you an example, who you know, you can walk right up to them and say, look, can you spend 5 minutes with me because I've got this problem? And because they're the kind of people who are stuck in, likely as not, they say, if you want a job doing, find a busy person to do it. Probably, if they're busy in the Lord, they'll probably say, yeah, I can give 5 minutes. And help you. The kind of battles, these kind of very ordinary day-to-day living battles, are actually the crucial battles for the ultimate victory. And they are best resourced by people who are on the ground with you, showing you the way in their own personal lives and also helping you in practical ways. You know about the Song of Deborah? You know what happens in the days of the judges with Deborah? You know about Deborah? Barak was officially speaking the ruler in Israel. He was your top dog, commander-in-chief of the armies of Israel. But when it came down to finally making some decisions around the place, rolling up their sleeves and listening to all the needs and the concerns of the people, helping them through the practical issues of their lives, who did they actually turn to? A woman called Deborah. She showed up. She was there. She sought God. He answered. And through the agency of her ministry, Israel was directed and led. Barak officially, that's the problem. What you really want in a church is the official leadership and the real spiritual leadership to be the same thing. Unfortunately, at that particular time, the real leadership was over here somewhere. The official leadership was over there. Two slightly separate things. That's what we were looking at a little bit this morning, wasn't it? The official leadership of Israel was this group of Pharisees and so on and so forth, who really shouldn't have been in post at all, most of them, because their attitudes were so wrong. And the real leadership, Jesus and so on, the disciples, were on the outside. That's not the way, ideally, those, you put the right people in the right, aces in their places. And Deborah was having to do it. But in the end, she showed up and she did it. And when it came to the battle, Barak said, I'll go to the battle, but only if you go with us. And they went into the battle, and they called all the Israelites to come in. And Judges chapter 5, verses 13 to 18, she sings this song after the victory is secured. And the fact is, a lot of the Israelites just didn't show up. They just didn't show up. And those that did are the ones that got the praise and the glory, because they're the ones that got stuck into the battle. They're the ones that, in the end, when you read that passage of Scripture, it's their names that get listed. They're the ones you have to look to. Those are the examples you have to follow. Because the others, I'm sure, would have been great soldiers, but they just didn't turn up. And that's how it works. So he's saying to them to just respect the fact there are people who right here amongst you are working hard. And they are your leaders. They're nobody else's leaders. They're your leaders. It's what God is doing in your midst. And these people, then there's this sort of slightly uncomfortable thing, the fact that he describes them as being over you. They are over you. They haven't forced themselves over you. They haven't been imposed upon you by some outside force. It's just the reality, the facts of the situation, because of their walk with God and their engagement things. That's the situation as it really is. They have something to teach you. And because of their experience, they have something to offer, and so on and so forth. And the word there, proestemai, over you, is guardianship. They've been given a responsibility by God to look out for you, to help you in the battle, to be a protective presence. You see, nobody likes trials. Nobody likes trouble. Well, no, you don't like trials and trouble, do you? No. But they do produce good fruit sometimes. And sometimes you get experience in the trial. You discover your powers and your strengths and your gifts in the trial. And you come through that trial. And everybody can see, you know, that was a terrible thing. But did you see that person, the way they came through? What glory to God that gave. And you say, look, look what the Lord is doing here in our midst. And finally, I just want to turn to this. What the character of their leadership? What's their leadership going to be like? These leaders are being raised up in the church in Thessalonica, local leaders. And it's a kind of, I have mixed feelings about this word. The word admonish. Have you got admonish there in your translation? They're working hard amongst you. They're over you in the Lord. And they will admonish you. Admonition. It's a kind of an odd word. It's not the sort of thing I feel particularly sympathetic. Nuphateo. It means to pressurize. It could be in a positive way, by encouragement. That kind of exerts a positive pressure, doesn't it? It kind of like, it says, look, you know, you can do it. That exerts some pressure, doesn't it? And it gives you an uplift, and up you go. Or it says, what do you think you're doing? That calls you into question, and so on and so forth. Either way, the point is that it doesn't just leave you where you are. There's some challenge. What leaders do is they challenge us. They just don't leave us in the status quo. And we all know that experience of rubbing alongside godly people. And I don't know what, you spend 5 minutes and you just think, I just don't pray half as much as I should. I don't know why. I've only spent a couple of minutes with this person. I just sort of feel like I'm this prayerless. It's not because they've said you must pray more often or anything. It's just something, their evident prayerfulness that makes you just go, I've got to pray more, you know? Other people, they just go, I haven't shared the gospel with anybody for ages. Why haven't I? Because there's something about the way they live their lives, so openly about Christ in their lives. It just makes you feel so convicted sometimes. And it can be really encouraging. It's a positive spur. But it doesn't leave you the same, does it? And that's what leaders do. They stir us up and they provoke us and they inspire us and they direct us and they make us question where we stand and unsettle us in a way. And yes, it encourages us and sometimes it makes us feel bad. But the important thing is that it gets us on the move. It stops us standing still. Because we're in the middle of a battle. In the middle of a battle, you know, it's one of the great military campaigns of, the, you know, with Napoleon Bonaparte when he went into Russia. I don't know what he was thinking, and Hitler did exactly the same. I just don't know what they were thinking, why they decided to invade Russia. It's just the most crazy idea ever, you know, because it's not the Russians that are going to get you. It's going to be the freezing weather. I mean, we think we've got weather. I mean, you just don't want to invade Russia, you know. And in the end, the people who died, the French and the Germans, all these people, they just died in their thousands and their hundreds of thousands. Why? Because they stood still. They just stood still. Once they stopped moving, they just froze to death, and that was the end of it. And the only way was just to keep moving. And they had to have their leaders just keep moving, keep moving, keep moving. It might have felt harsh, it might have felt unpleasant, but it's a difference of life and death. Difference between life and death. And we need to keep moving. We need to keep alive. We need to keep active. The church will not grow by standing still and doing nothing. There's a time to spend with God, be still and know that I am God, but that is not the status quo. There is no, we're not there yet. The battle is not won yet. There are still 2,000 people on our doorstep who don't know Christ. We have no room for being complacent, and nor does any other Christian anywhere else in the whole wide world. Because we're not in heaven yet. We can rest when we get there. Right? We can rest when we get there. Yeah, we've got to take breathers. We've got to take breaks. But we've got work to do. I mean, it would be tempting, wouldn't it, to reject people who effectively provoke you and stir you up. It could be annoying. It could become annoying. But he says, esteem them. Esteem them. And that means give them first place. That's a very high thing, isn't it? He's basically telling them to call and appoint officers, isn't he? He's saying, you know, give these people their rightful places. Recognize them in their midst. You know, you want to start building a church here. And that esteem, he emphasizes with the word very highly. Very highly esteem these people. in terms of the battle, these are the people you want to be giving the Victoria Cross to. These are the ones who should be getting the medals because of their courage under fire, the way they conduct themselves in the trials of life. But having said all this, by conclusion, let's notice the tone of this. Let's just finally notice the tone of this. He asks them. Okay? It's an ask. And he asks them to give these people this respect. Okay? He's not taking it from them. It's not a demand. He's saying, this is what I want you to do. And it's really down to them to prayerfully consider it and decide whether to do it or not. Because it's only you can give true respect. Only you can give loyalty to people. It's a free thing, isn't it? It's free. And he also reminds them that the authority they have is in the Lord. It doesn't mean inherently these are better people and that they're because of that they're also going to be better at running and better at maths and better in everything else. It's just we're talking about their spiritual life, just in this area, just in this one area of their life. You know, you don't have to, you know, say they're all wonderful about everything. No. It's just in this. In their walk with God and the way they help you. And that in the end, the respect that you're being offered, that's being asked for from you, is simply that you love them. Which is what you've got to do for everybody else anyway. Isn't it? You just got to love people. And you've got to love your leaders. The leaders have got to love you. That's just the way it is. But the relationships make love sometimes a bit more complicated sometimes. But you just got to love them anyway. Because that's the way Christian life works. And in the end, why does he want you to love these people? Why does he want you to appreciate them and so on, respect them? Yes, for the sake of the battle. It is in the end, it's not so they can feel good about themselves and enjoy their job. It's for the sake of the work. It's for what has to be achieved. So the Thessalonica had to be secured for the gospel, and they're the people who had to do it, and that's what had to be done to do it. And that's the way it is here. We've got a work to do here. And it needs to be done. And that's why in the end he just says, so live in peace. Seems like good advice, doesn't it? To live in peace, do you think? Live in peace appeals to me.